This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We learned early on that if you can get enough people to the scene of an abduction, ICE will flee. You know, the devil doesn't like to be seen.
Minneapolis workers fight ICE repression and defend the rights of the indicted Minneapolis 15.
We started going out there and observing the ICE flights and pretty much seeing people on that tarmac in shackles being walked across towards the staging facility.
Activists expose ICE's private deportation flights and organize against a massive detention complex in Alexandria, Louisiana.
Russia had a right of collective self-defense to intervene in Ukraine to defend the Donbass and the Russian-speaking people in the Donbass who were being subjected to a war by Kiev, which killed 14,000 people before Russia even intervened. And I think people need to remember that if they ever knew it to begin with.
Lawyer and author Dan Kovalik speaks to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke in part two of their interview about Ukraine, Russia, Russiagate, and the prospects for the Cuban and Bolivarian revolutions. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. According to Minneapolis activists, Trump planned the mass ICE occupation of the city to intimidate and crush community and working class resistance to ICE. Instead, it sparked massive community and labor mobilization against the agency. The crackdown has also led to several felony conspiracy indictments, including the case of the Minneapolis 15. Cal Robinette, an electrician and a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW Local 110, was one of those federally indicted. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the struggle and the lessons workers and the community can draw from it.
It's hard to live in the city and not be involved in the movement against ICE. It's hard to not do something when you can walk down the street and see these masked armed secret police look like military people just walking down the street and kidnapping your neighbors. There was a period this winter where you literally could not leave the house and not see them. They sent over 4,000 armed thugs to try and kidnap our neighbors, executed people in the street, hold children hostage, and try to intimidate everybody around them. And so me and more than 100,000 other people, you know, saw what was going on and decided to do something about it. And, you know, I think that I'm somebody who is pretty involved, but I'm not special in that way. You know, this was a very broad horizontal movement of people that worked together to try and defend their communities from this terror.
Most people I've seen ICE, or in particularly in black and brown communities, but the whole military type operation, and of course Minneapolis was not the only city. In Chicago, they had a helicopter, Apache helicopter, land on a building, raided the building in the black community. In Los Angeles, they had these ICE agents going throughout the city, rounding people up. I mean, these kind of tactics of the government, of Trump and ICE, and you're saying there was a big reaction to that and people got organized against it in Minneapolis.
That's right. I think that there are a couple of major reasons that Minneapolis was targeted for this kind of quote-unquote immigration enforcement that was anything but. You know, less than 2% of our population is undocumented here. This was never about immigration. This was always about punishment. You know, it's notable that our governor was Trump's political opponent in the last election. And it's Trump himself has repeatedly gone off about, you know, days of retribution for people that, you know, seem to have wronged him. But maybe more importantly than that specifically is that The Twin Cities has a long history of, successful protest movements against state terror. And, most notably and recently, during the George Floyd uprising, the people of the Twin Cities came together to do all kinds of supporting and protecting their neighbors. And we were able to win a pretty big victory against the state in that way. And I think that part of the reason that we were targeted was because of, our ideology, our speech, our organizing from what happened back then. But also part of the reason that we were able to successfully mobilize and organize is because we've been through this before, right? This isn't the first, mass uprising against state terror that's happened in the Twin Cities. And we've continually learned lessons. I think all the way back to like Jamar Clark and Marcus Golden kind of era in the mid 2010s, and it feels to me like every time that there's some sort of like public execution by the state, that more people get involved, more people see what's happening for what it is, and they decide to do something about it. And this last one was just so large and so hard to ignore. When they raided my house, they sent two helicopters after me, a team of militarized door kickers came in, they smashed my window, they held my young roommates at gunpoint, they dragged me out into the rain in my underwear. It was really aggressive. And for them, the violence is the point, the process is the punishment. This is all for show. If they sent me to jail, it's not like people would stop organizing. You know what I mean? I'm not like a secret leader of the resistance in the way that they want to paint all of us as, right? We're all just normal people that are involved in this stuff, because we can't stand to see our neighbors get kidnapped off the streets and sent to concentration camps. It's really kind of hard for me to describe the emotional weight of what happened here, without using religious terms. I grew up Catholic, Steve, and so the only way I can really describe it is that I saw the face of the devil out there. He wears a mask to hide who he is because he doesn't want to be seen for who he is. And when there's something so obvious and clear like that happening, it's hard for anybody of conscience to not want to do something about it.
And these terror tactics, were people prepared for targeting like that? I mean, the idea, first of all, that they'll first target immigrants, so-called non-citizens, and people who they say don't belong in this country. And then they go after people who are taking video of their actions, and even killing them, murdering them, and getting away. They just released one of the murderers in Texas who was under indictment. It seems like these kind of murderous actions are the state, the federal government is saying it's okay. You can get away with this. Is that frightening? And what was the reaction in Minneapolis to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in particular, the types of things that we see with the state going after people that film them, people that record them, is maybe best represented by the other major Minnesota case right now, this Righteous 39 church protest that happened where they arrested Don Lemon and Georgia Fort, and they're charging them with violating the FACE Act, which is a act that was passed in order to prevent the KKK from targeting abortion clinics and black churches. So it's pretty clear kind of what's happening for those that are paying attention. But I will say that I'm not afraid of them, and none of my friends are afraid of them. If they're trying to do one thing, it's trying to make us afraid. And that's the one thing that we can't let them do. We have to keep going out there. We have to keep using our voices. We have to keep documenting what they do, because if enough of them of us are out there doing that, then they will stop doing it, right? We learned early on that if you can get enough people to the scene of an abduction, ICE will flee. You know, the devil doesn't like to be seen. So it's important for us to keep protecting ourselves and our neighbors, because especially those of us in the queer community recognize, you know, especially what this administration's been doing to trans people and some of this other more recent stuff regarding trying to turn back marriage equality and other attacks on the LGBTQ community, that we're next on the docket. You know, this was never really specifically about immigrants in any way that in any way that makes it an exceptional kind of like case for that. They're just going after a scapegoat, and when they're done with one, they'll go for the next one. You know, a lot of the people in the rapid response and mutual aid efforts in the Twin Cities are made up, you know, specifically of queer and trans people, because we recognize our own lot in this as well. So yeah, if there's one message I really want to get out to people, you know, yes, talk about our case, yes, donate money, but most importantly, I want people to keep going out there and doing what we've been doing. They're afraid of what we've been doing because it works, and that's the one thing that we gotta keep our eyes on the prize about.
And the fascist ideology, would you say it's comparable to Hitler? Because Hitler did target gays and lesbians and executed them, put them in concentration camps, that they were the enemy, that they were the sick and they should be destroyed. I mean, is there a parallel between what happened in Germany to gays and lesbians and the targeting of gays and lesbians today and LGBTQ people?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of parallels to a lot of far right governments and moments of terror throughout history, and I think that there are certainly some we could learn from, you know, the late Weimar Republic, but there's also ones that we could learn from, you know, the Argentine Dirty War. Those who spoke out against what was happening, especially union activists, were targeted for disappearances there. And it's something that I'm thinking a lot about as we think about the whole union aspect of what's been going on with Minnesota 15 in particular, right? When 11 of the 15 people that were, you know, rounded up and put on a show trial are known union activists, it paints a pretty clear picture about what's been going on.
And the targeting of the union activists, I think part of that is that unions activists and some union locals were organizing in Minneapolis. Why don't you talk about how that took place, how they did organize the formation of these worker assemblies? How were workers and unions organized in Minneapolis to fight the ICE terror against immigrants and also now the defense case that is being taken up?
I think that when Trump was elected for the second time, a lot of us in the labor movement took a kind of long-term approach to this, right? Like, we knew that the Twin Cities were going to be a target for the reasons I previously stated, and that we would need to have some kind of response ready for what would happen when they started to come down on us. And so across a dozen different union locals, we started organizing these worker assemblies, doing things like, you know, fundraisers and socials and Skillshares and, you know, coming into the Metro Surge invasion, you know, more specifically protests and assemblies on collective decision making. And there were a lot of different participants from a lot of different unions. You know, at our big assembly had nearly 400 people present, and that room was so packed that It was standing room only at the back. And there are some unions that have been very, very active in resistance to ICE outside of this. Most especially is Minneapolis Federation of Educators, who has done a lot of work in trying to ensure student safety where the school administration has refused to step in. Everybody here is familiar with the execution of Renee Good, but a lot of people are a little less familiar that day that ICE literally attacked Roosevelt, I believe it's high school. They tried to storm in the front door, and teachers and custodial workers tried to stop them from kidnapping children, and a few of them were detained as well.
So
I think that, like,
they were raiding public schools, trying to
yeah,
grab these kids, terrorize
they
the
tried,
kids.
and especially at pick up and drop off, they would try to snatch up these children and use them as bait. I mean, we all saw the case of Liam Ramos, but this was a daily occurrence that the federal government was trying to worm their way into these child safety networks. And one of my favorite stories that I like to tell about what was happening was one of the parents had kind of a suspicious encounter with someone that they didn't know. So it was already, the parents and the teachers that were involved. And so they got their neighborhood ICE Watch group to start, posting lookouts around the school. And they had to have some sort of way to differentiate themselves so that they knew who was, a valid lookout and who was someone who was trying to impersonate them. So they started to wear these high-vis vests, but one of the, I believe one of the parents said that that might upset the kids, and so they got the local knitting club involved to knit specific hats for everybody. And then they got the local hacker club involved to give people presentations on how does it look when somebody's trying to trick their way into your information network? And so I think, like, the strongest stories that we see of resistance coming out of Metro Surge are the people that are able to bridge the gap between all of these different social networks, all of these different movements, and put them together. And that's part of why the 15 of us were investigated, right? I think that, among us, we have people in MFE, we have people in IBW, we have people in UBC, we have people in MAPE, we have people in AUP, and we also have someone in SEIU Healthcare. So you see, like, the broad swaths of industries and perspectives that people are coming to this with. And that's what makes us effective, is those of us that can bridge the gap and bring us all together.
That was Cal Robinette, a union electrician and one of the indicted Minneapolis 15, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Yelling, melt the ice all day, all night. It ain't right. Now they taking wild lives. It's your Project 25, killing with their crimes. Kidnapping, hear the cries. Got the mamas and the babies hiding up inside. Homie checking on me from in wide of the shot. Got the mayor calling in on the other line. Said it's coming all over, red from both sides. Twin Cities tear gassing, burning both eyes. Chris showed the pics. Georgia 4 went live. We lighting candles on the west, prayers for the south side. We don't know what's next. We just trying to survive. Try to tell them they didn't listen. Now I spit it in a rhyme. Let the drones hear the drums from the farms to the slums. There's a war outside and they want us all gone.
That was Maria Isa singing Que se vaya el hielo, Ice Leave Minnesota. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Behind the massive deportation machine, funded by more than $70 billion, is a growing network of private airlines that activists have dubbed ICE Air. These companies make money transporting ICE detainees around the country, often with little public oversight or transparency. A Tegna documentary by lead reporter Vandervine, titled Air ICE, investigates this private detention and deportation network. We'll hear part of that documentary, followed by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewing activists in Alexandria, Louisiana, where a growing detention complex is holding thousands of people. The activists are working to find out what is happening inside the facility and bring that information to the local community and to people across the United States.
And we will begin the largest deportation operation in the history of the United States. We will defend our territory. We will not be conquered. We will not be conquered.
Quick arrests, quicker removals. Millions wanted it. Millions voted for it.
And we will be very, very effective in doing it.
And remove the government has now done hundreds of thousands of times.
It's going to happen very, very fast. We're going to get them the hell out of our country.
The fulfillment of a campaign promise made and kept. This is not what we sought to investigate.
We don't know the rhyme or reason for it, honestly.
A lot of, I think, what we're seeing over the past year is just chaos.
Somewhere between arrest and removal, we found something else. At some of the nation's busiest airports, a massive immigration enforcement operation takes place daily, just beyond the next gate.
It's astounding, just the number of people that are moved daily.
These flights don't leave America. They cross it.
People are being treated like Amazon packages, kind of just shuffled about.
I had a client detained in Maryland who ended up in Louisiana, then in Texas, then finally to Tacoma, where I met her.
Buried within millions of lines of data, we found the routes, the airports, and in some instances,
you had no idea where you
No.
The passengers themselves.
Me llevaron a Denver, Colorado.
Flights filled with people not headed to other countries, but to other states.
Jesus.
And often, it's not clear why.
Y cuando nos subieron el avión, yo no vi nada. Nos fuimos de ahí, pero no sabíamos para dónde. Yo no sabía para dónde íbamos.
A billion-dollar-plus interstate system few know exists.
Huge amounts of funding from the U.S. government are going in with very little oversight.
And they're shuffled around not just to one facility, but multiple facilities across the country.
Do you get the sense some judges are growing frustrated by this?
Absolutely.
Where leaders promise speed, efficiency, and scale, we found movement, confusion, and secrecy.
They could literally be moved overnight and I won't know.
And sometimes even those who try to leave, who want to leave,
he should have been deported, right?
Somehow don't.
You thought he was ready to go back to Nicaragua?
See.
This is what happens when a system designed to remove simply moves people around.
So we're not really any closer to knowing what happened.
This is ICE Air. They cross American skies over cities big and small. Every day the planes move thousands from one spot in the U.S. to another. To understand how it works, we decided to follow one plane on one day. Multiple stops, multiple locations, multiple crews.
People don't realize what's happening in our community.
Our day started in eastern Ohio.
People don't feel it, they don't see it.
In Youngstown.
This is what our country is doing. This is what's happening.
This 737, operated by Eastern Air Express, is one part of a massive ICE Air fleet.
They have progressively moved the planes behind the airport.
Here, we met Chris Harris, part of an informal national network of observers who document the flights.
And at this point now, They're pulling the loading ramps to block any kind of visuals.
On its webpage, Immigration and Customs Enforcement says that detainees may be transferred to other facilities to eliminate overcrowding or meet special detainee needs.
Two flights a day leaving Youngstown in the morning.
We don't know who boarded this flight or why they boarded. ICE will not discuss ongoing or future operations, citing security concerns. We do know, based on our reporting, this flight went by the flight number Tyson 57. We know that because we built our own database using downloadable but little-known flight information to find the flights and planes used by ICE Air operations. From Ohio, Tyson 57 traveled east to Bedford, Massachusetts.
If you told me a year ago that I'd be doing this, I would say you're crazy.
This is where Todd Palmer, another observer, waited. He understands more than most. ICE doesn't like to advertise where it goes.
What we're seeing here is a piece of a nationwide, giant-scale, secret operation whisking people around the country and then out of the country.
Much like celebrities or wealthy jet-setters who want to keep their travels private, ICE uses a federal system known as LAD, or Limiting Aircraft Data Displayed, to remove many of its flights from many flight tracking websites. They're not invisible to radar. But if you looked up this plane on flightaware.com on this day, for example, you would have never seen it, and thus would have missed its third stop in Indianapolis, Indiana. Here, another crew of ours recorded detainees boarding Tyson 57 in leg and arm shackles. ICE calls the restraints standard protocol and an essential measure to ensure the safety and well-being of both detainees and officers' agents accompanying them.
We're just seeing that these flights are kind of crisscrossing our country.
Savi Arvi works for Human Rights First, an immigrant advocacy group that monitors what some call shuffle flights, these domestic-only transfers.
Everyone should care about these flights in particular.
She worries flights intended to assist with deportation also appear to be doing something else.
The flights within the United States often shuffle people between detention centers and deportation facilities, sometimes with little explanation.
These aren't just city-by-city pickups of prisoners, she says. To her, it's a deliberate government plan to play keep away.
And I think there are great concerns that these flights are then taking people away from their attorneys.
When it comes to ICE air operations, no place plays a larger role than Alexandria, Louisiana, a town of less than 50,000 that sits in a parish that voted 2-1 in favor of President Donald Trump.
So a lot of people feel that this is what they voted for, so they're pleased.
She doesn't want us to use her name, mostly because of where she lives and she does.
They will open the doors and all these people will start pouring out in shackles and just like shuffling. You'll see them line up and they just keep coming.
This is the nation's busiest ICE Air hub. It sits just beyond the back nine of the Oak Wing Golf Club.
You can come out here any day of the week and you're going to witness flights.
On this day, it was also Tyson 57's fourth stop. One flight, one day, 2,000 miles, dozens of detainees picked up and shipped south. Every stop raised the same questions. Who was ICE moving and why? In 2023, the then acting ICE director in front of Congress estimated these charter flights run $17,000 an hour. This day's journey, 7 hours. By that estimation, 119,000 from start to finish. And Tyson 57 was hardly alone that day. We identified, tracked, traced 65 flights in all. A vast daily network few know and even fewer understand.
People deserve to know what happens to them, not to disappear into the black hole.
And most of these flights, as you can see, never left the country.
It's not like anything I've ever seen before.
Hi, my name is Crystal Rahman. I'm a social worker in Louisiana and also
a member of Indivisible North Louisiana.
My name is Erin Tracy. I'm in Alexandria with the group Sinla Activism.
Okay, so why don't we talk about this detention center and how you found out about it, how you got involved, and what's happening with it?
I first became aware of the GEO staging facility at Alexandria International Airport after the first No Kings protest, where I met some new friends. I had just moved back into town. I grew up in this area, but I'd done a lot of traveling, a lot of living elsewhere. And so I was back in this area and trying to meet like-minded people. And my friend alerted me to the staging facility at the airport. And we started going out there and observing the ICE flights. And pretty much, I have never been out there and not seen people on that tarmac in shackles being walked across towards the staging facility. So we just began observing and recording that information, thinking that it would be useful for documentation, you know, historical purposes, and just to make sure that it was being like watched. And then from there, we became aware of the sort of governmental structure at the air park. And so the way it's set up, it's its own political subdivision of the state, and it's not subject to regulation by any of the other government, or I shouldn't say regulation, but like they don't answer to anybody. The authority board and the directors, it's sort of like the director, he's the executive body, the board is the legislative body, and they operate outside of the rest of the political system of Louisiana. And so we became privy to the fact that they had monthly board meetings, and they're not well publicized. We were able to find out that they're on the fourth Thursday of every month. And so in February, we knew when it was going to be. We were looking for an agenda. The agenda comes out one day in advance only. And so the day before that February meeting, we saw on the agenda items about a contract with DHS, ICE, and LaSalle Corrections for a specific building on the property. And we also saw an item about creating a new sub-district that would be the site of a data center as well. And so we knew about that one day in advance. We got a couple of people who were willing to show up. And I think there were five of us in total that went to that board meeting. And we listened to a woman from a group called Compass Connections give a presentation on building or running a supposedly humanitarian facility that would be a way to keep families and children together and safe before self-deporting. But we believe that all of that is lies. We have proof that there are lies. We have proof that that company is no longer involved. So it pretty much just snowballed from there. As soon as we heard that, we're contacting everyone we can, everyone we know in various organizations that are helping immigrants. And so from February until now, it's just been, who can we bring into this group to fight this? What organizations, what community members? And let's just get as much attention, as much legal expertise, as much, you know, any kind of other expertise on it as we possibly can. And let's make sure that our own community, as well as the entire country, is aware of this because, you know, it's shrouded in secrecy. They thought they wouldn't have any pushback because, you know, they didn't want anybody to know. And so that's currently what we're working on right now.
That was a segment from the documentary Air Ice, followed by an interview with activists organizing in Alexandria, Louisiana, who are working to expose the operations of a massive detention complex that they say is holding as many as 8,000 people. They were speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Everyone, oh everyone, oh everyone of these people are ours, just like we are theirs. We belong to them and they belong to us.
Singing Resistance, We Belong to Each Other. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Next, labor and human rights lawyer and author Dan Kovalik speaks to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke in part two of their interview about Ukraine, Russia, Russiagate, and prospects for the Cuban and Bolivarian revolutions. Part one aired on our August 31st show.
Your first book was called The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the
Yes.
CIA and Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia, published, as I said earlier, in 2017 by Skyhorse. What was your argument in that book, and how have subsequent events in Ukraine borne out your argument?
Well, my argument then, and it is now, is that Russia should not be an enemy of the U.S., that in fact Putin, you know, did a lot to try to curry favor with the U.S., including during the war on terror, and did a lot to help with the war on terror, especially in Afghanistan, where Russia still had a lot of assets. And the other thing, I debunked the Russiagate conspiracy. You know, I argued very vociferously that there's no evidence that Russia interfered in the 2016 election. And I think that history has borne me out on that, that was never true, that interference happened. And in terms of Ukraine, I mean, I predicted that there would be, you know, a conflagration if the difficulty in the Donbass was not dealt with, which it never was.
I think you're right, absolutely, What Russiagate showed was the bipartisan nature of American imperialism when it comes to so many aspects of foreign policy. Obviously, the Cold War was a bipartisan campaign. Both major factions of the American ruling class, stopped their petty arguments because, killing communists or screwing with communists was, was a blood sport that they both enjoyed. But of course, with the implosion of the Soviet Union, they continue to sort of red bait Russia, but really what they're eyeing at Russia is, of course, what the Soviet Union also represented: 1/6 of the landmass of the planet, you know, vast resources, vast territories that you know, are worthy of gobbling up, or at least extracting where one can. And geopolitically, based on, I guess it was the, you know, that crazed Cold Warrior Zbigniew Brzezinski, you know, they want to break up Russia into, you know, at least 3 or possibly 9 different territories, just much more easily exploitable, I assume. What are your thoughts?
Yes, and I think that's still the goal, you know. And what Russia learned after the collapse of the Soviet Union is that the West had as much problem with Russia as it did with the Soviet Union. And Russia had hoped that they'd be welcomed into the West and into Europe after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that never happened, right? They were never welcomed. And yes, I think the West has always seen Russia as an Eastern kind of Asiatic country that would never, you know, be part of the West, and that was a country that, you know, ripe for exploitation. And they've always resented the fact that it's been a major power for a long time. And so I think it's very clear that what the Ukraine war is about is an attack by the West, the collective West, against Russia to weaken it. And yes, to carve it up. I think they would like to make it into several different countries, which they could then exploit and control. And so we'll see what happens. But I think that, you know, we're in the midst of that conflict right now.
I crafted this question with sort of a long intro, but suffice it to say, I became aware in college of the so-called just war theories, both of through human or international legal standards, and as well as Catholic theology, morality. And as far as I can see, one of the few examples of a just war in any sense in the past century, besides resistance, colonial occupations across, you know, during the Cold War, etc., is the Russian Federation's special military operation in Ukraine. Given the several Minsk agreements that were signed and then violated by the Maidan coup government, of which the U.S. and NATO backed and installed and backed and funded to the hilt, the increased military and paramilitary violence against Russian speakers in the Donbass that you've already alluded to, and the buildup to a renewed offensive by the Ukraine government in late 2021 and early 22. Would you agree with that statement, that it was a just war? And what do you believe will happen when the Russian military invariably prevails, as I believe they will, and destroys the Ukrainian military resistance? And what should the attitude of international socialists be to this outcome?
Well, I have argued as an international law professor that Russia had a right of collective self-defense to intervene in Ukraine to defend the Donbass and the Russian-speaking people in the Donbass who were being subjected to a war by Kiev, which killed 14,000 people before Russia even intervened. And I think people need to remember that if they ever knew it to begin with. And by the way, I visited the Donbass 4 times in the last 5 or 6 years. And I can tell you that people were very glad that Russia intervened when it did, and actually had hoped it would intervene sooner. So I agree with you that it was, I think, a just intervention. Now, in terms of what happens afterwards, I hope this war ends soon. I don't know what will be done once Kiev is probably defeated. I think the international socialist movement should certainly oppose any military intervention, either in Ukraine or Russia, by the West. I mean, that's really our duty, is to oppose intervention by our own governments in countries like Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah. The defense of Ukraine is, you know, by various strata of the American ruling, I mean, the entire American ruling class, and the liberals say, you know, it's, they were attacked, et cetera, et cetera. But, and they refuse to recognize what the Ukrainian government actually is, as well as the American history with Ukrainian fascists, Banderites, people that, Gusanos that were picked up during and after World War II, refurbished with, you know, political, for political and industrial combat in the Soviet Union. In other words, the Americans have been using Ukraine just like they've been using other groups in the past for their own purposes. I'm thinking, for example, the Vietnamese, you know, landlords, as well as what's the most recent one? The Kurds, for example, the Kurds that have been used by American foreign policy to attack various groups in the Middle East and have never actually been rewarded with their own country. But Ukrainians are a special case, and it's an especially bloody one. So speak about the Ukrainian fascists and the current regime.
Yeah, well, the CIA, we know, the U.S., and particularly the CIA, have been supporting neo-Nazis in Ukraine for some time in order to, again, try to attack Russia and undermine Russia. And so, and after 2014, after the coup there that Obama administration supported, it brought to power a rightist government with strong Nazi elements. And those Nazi elements are the ones that really led the attack on the Russian-speaking people of the Ukraine that began very shortly after the coup in 2014. So I think, and by the way, the mainstream press before the special military operations began at least would acknowledge the existence of these neo-Nazis. And then once Russia intervened, they pretended they didn't exist. But in fact, at one point, Congressman John Conyers of Detroit, he sponsored a bill making it illegal for the U.S. to support military units in Ukraine that were led by neo-Nazis, which, of course, strongly suggests there were such Nazis. And then, of course, that bill was repealed. I guess the U.S. felt they needed to keep supporting the neo-Nazis. So, in any case, I think that we really have to acknowledge the nature of that government, and it is fascist.
Yeah. I mean, we use the term Nazi, but of course, the Ukrainian right, the Banderites are ultra-nationalists, which, of course, in Ukraine may not mean Nazi, but like the Nazis referred to the Eastern European fascists that they used for their so-called Einsatzgruppen, their substitute forces, some of them were even bloodier than the Nazi, the SS or anyone in the Wehrmacht, and they were sometimes expressed being appalled by the bloodthirstiness of these Eastern European fascists.
Oh yeah, the Ukrainian fascists were particularly brutal.
Yeah,
and some of the worst atrocities were carried out by the Ukrainian fascists. And again, those fascists still exist. Well, in fact, the former president of Uruguay, Pepe Mujica, can't even call them neo-Nazis because they're just straight up Nazis. You know, they still have roots back to World War II.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And South America was certainly part of the rat line that American and British intelligence used to funnel out Nazis and Einsatzgruppen that they wanted to employ during the Cold War. Well, final question, and I know you have time is limited. I should have asked this earlier. Describe the Bolivarian Revolution under Chavez, and please try to compare it to both the Cuban Revolution of the Castro guerrilla army, as well as, if possible, the actual Russian Bolshevik Revolution of Lenin and Trotsky. And I know that's a huge question, but...
Well, I mean, I think it's the first difference between the Venezuelan Revolution and the Cuban and Russian Revolution is that it came to power through elections, right? The other two came to power through armed insurrection. And so the nature of the Venezuelan Revolution was different in that it was a peaceful revolution, which is good to some degree, but it also wasn't as far-reaching in the sense that you still had bourgeois elements that had a lot of power and influence because they were never defeated, right? And you had a lot of, you know, leaders in the military that were still loyal to the Anshin regime, as we say.
I mean, it's my understanding that there was never really a serious land reform in Venezuela, was there? During the...
No.
Okay.
No, and there were weird things. You know, you had like, you know, this company called Polar, which is basically the main food distributor of Venezuela. It was never nationalized, and it would, you know, it would cause shortages during elections to try to influence the election. And it was never brought to heel by Chavez. So, I mean, with all that said, Chavez did a lot to lower poverty and extreme poverty, to provide education and health care to the population. He did a lot. But again, because it was a revolution that, you know, was still dependent on elections and in basically – therefore negotiating with the bourgeoisie, you know, it had vulnerabilities. And I think we see that now, you know, that it's been hard to sustain it. Let's put it that way.
So you could argue that it was never really institutionalized either. I mean, were there changes to the Venezuelan constitution that are, you know, irrevocable at this point, or
well, there were, you know, there was a people's constitution put in place that was drafted through, you know, constitutional assemblies throughout the country. It was voted, it was approved by a national referendum, and so it did institutionalize the revolution to some extent. But the one thing it didn't do, Chavez tried, it was the only election Chavez ever lost, tried to get put in the constitution that Venezuela would be a socialist country. And that vote failed. And so that part of the revolution is not institutionalized. That is to say, you could have, you know, a capitalist party win an election and undo the social program. So that, to that extent, again, it's vulnerable.
That was lawyer and author Dan Kovalik speaking with Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about the Ukraine war and the future of Cuba and Venezuela. You can hear part one of this interview in last week's August 31st show on our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, Anne Garrison, and myself, Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Please subscribe to receive a link to each week's show via email. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.